Welcome to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and today we are speaking with William Ferriolo. He is the author of Meditations on Self-Discipline and Failure, Stoic Exercise for Mental Fitness. William has a PhD in philosophy from the University of Oklahoma, and he teaches philosophy at San Joaquin Delta College in California. Welcome to the show, William.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for being with us. Do you prefer William or Bill?
People who call me Bill or Billy. William's on the book, but take your choice.
All right. we'll just see how it comes out. Okay.
Sure.
So this is the first time that we've really gone into Stoicism in any depth here on Synchronicity. So just so that we're all on the same page, what does it mean to be a Stoic philosopher?
Okay. It's important to distinguish between lowercase s Stoicism, which is a general psychological, emotional attitude, kind of the British stiff upper lip, keep calm and carry on attitude, and capital S Stoic philosophy. So Stoicism was a school of Greco-Roman philosophy. It was founded by Zeno of Citium, and it kind of reached its apex in terms of moral philosophy and advice regarding self-discipline in the Roman Stoics. Epictetus, Marcus Aurelius, who was an emperor, and Seneca. There are others such as Musonius Rufus. We don't have much of his work. But would you like me to describe sort of some of the central tenets of Stoicism?
Sure, yeah. What does it mean to be a uppercase level Stoic?
Okay. Stoics teach us that it is crucial to distinguish between that which is within our control and that which lies beyond our control. That which is within our control, the Stoics referred to as internals. And essentially, all we can ultimately control is what they refer to as the proheresis, which is a Greek term, translates roughly to your faculty of deliberation and choice. One can always control one's attitude, the direction of one's will, one's expectations, and so on, whereas one cannot control external states of affairs. I cannot control what other people do, say, think, feel. I cannot ultimately even control my own body, my own corpus. We age, we are frail, we die, we get ill. Unfortunately, most people spend a lot of time and mental energy, and they burn up a lot of their available resources pursuing the control of externals that are ultimately beyond our control. The Stoics teach us that it is much more rational and much healthier to direct all of our energies at self-discipline, self-control, maintaining our reason, maintaining our decency, our virtue, etc. If we just focused on that, many of life's anxieties, the things that make us angry, the things that cause us to be ill at ease, they simply fade away. They cease to have the power over us that that they all too often do.
Thank you, William. Now, you have a PhD in philosophy, so I imagine you've studied a lot of philosophers, not just the Stoics. So are there any other kind of philosophies that are in opposition to Stoicism?
Yes, their primary rivals in the ancient Greco-Roman world were probably the Epicureans. Their founder, Epicurus, argued that the good is pleasure, and that the pursuit of pleasure really constitutes what philosophers in the Hellenistic period called eudaimonia, or the good life or flourishing. So the Epicureans argued essentially that the wise thing to do is to pursue easily attainable pleasures, physical pleasures, psychological, emotional pleasures, and to kind of otherwise divorce oneself from things that that inhibit pleasure or that interfere with pleasure. Whereas the Stoics and before them the Cynics, the Stoics are sort of descended from the Cynics, people like Diogenes and Antisthenes, they taught that the ultimate pursuit, the centerpiece of the good life, is virtue. Wisdom and virtue is sufficient to live a good, flourishing life. There were other competing schools as well. There were the skeptics, and there were, you know, the sort of descendants of Plato's Academy. There were the Peripatetics, the descendants from Aristotle. There were a number of competing worldviews during the Hellenistic period, sort of right after Alexander the Great died, and for some years after that.
Thank you. Again, we are speaking with William Ferriolo. He is the author of many articles, but we're talking today about his book, Meditations on Self-Discipline and Failure, Stoic Exercise for Mental Fitness. So I'm just curious, William, with all of these competing worldviews, and right now we seem to be faced with a lot of competing worldviews going on in the media, so all over the place. What made you choose Stoicism over all these other ones?
Well, it's kind of took a circuitous route. It's a long story, but I'll give you the Reader's Digest abridged version. And I always tell people this. Interestingly enough, I became a philosopher and ultimately became a Stoic philosopher because I blew out my knee on my 18th birthday.
Oh.
not the normal route, as far as I'm aware. But I had an ROTC scholarship. I don't know if you have that in Canada. In America, it's the Reserve Officer Training Corps. It's a military scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a scholarship to go to college. It was all going to be paid for. But on my 18th birthday at wrestling practice, the very last wrestling practice of my life, in the last 5 minutes, I destroyed my knee. Two ligaments torn, meniscus blown out. So lost the scholarship and had to radically rethink my future.
Bummer.
Yes, it was a bit of a shocker. I had always been kind of a jock in high school. I had not, you know, regarded myself as a budding intellectual or anything like that. But I thought I might see if my brain could do something. And as it turns out, the answer is a little, but not a great deal. But I went through. I went to Penn State my first year. I transferred to Rutgers, and while I was at Rutgers, I was taking some philosophy courses just because they fit my schedule. And I asked one of my professors one day, I was really kind of starting to fall in love with studying philosophy. I thought, wow, these people pursue questions in the way that I always have. And I asked one of my professors, can I make a living, you know, doing philosophy? And he said, no. But I had no idea what else to do. So I stuck around until someone shoved a degree in my face. I ended up going to the University of Oklahoma for graduate school. You hang out long enough, someone hands you a PhD. You look for a job. Found one here at San Joaquin Delta College in Stockton, California. And about when I hit my 30s, I began to have very severe manifestations of an anxiety disorder that I and my brothers inherited from my father. And it was pretty dicey. I was very angry, had a terrible temper. I couldn't sleep. I was having a hard time keeping food down. And just at a propitious moment, I encountered the discourses of Epictetus. And not too far into the text, I realized, wait, this guy is advising me to do the only thing that seems remotely plausible for getting some kind of command of this anxiety problem and the depression that tends to go along with it. So I kind of slid into the study of Stoicism, and once it took hold, there was no turning back. There was no way out. It resonated with me so strongly, so deeply, that I knew I had to learn everything I could about it. And now I'm at a point in my life. I'm 48 years old now, and I'm at a point at which I would like to sort of pass along the message to the next generation, to those coming up. I would like to encourage people to explore Stoicism as a way of dealing with the vicissitudes of the human condition that, you know, periodically plague all of us. We all have to deal with fear, anxiety, anger, dysfunctional psychological, emotional states. And Stoicism is it's one answer. I don't claim it's the only answer, but it's one answer that has been enormously helpful for me, and I hope to encourage others to pursue it.
Thank you, William. I actually deal with a lot of depression in my own life, and no matter how much work I do on myself, it still seems to come up in waves, as is probably common for a lot of people. So I'm just curious about how much the anxiety and depression has changed based on your studying Stoicism, and how much is it just sort of, you have to kind of ride it out?
The study of Stoicism, and of course this is assiduous study over many years, it's not like flipping a light switch, but what's enabled me to do is reason my way out of the kinds of mental states that are most dangerous for myself and for others. It used to be that I would get angry, the anger would intensify, and I would remain in that condition for extended periods of time, like sort of extended periods of rage. And now when I notice something like anger or something like an intense bout of anxiety arising, I can usually I can become aware of it much more readily than I used to. I am able to reason about its probable causes and its probable consequences. And most importantly, I am able to recognize the irrationality underpinning that state and to reason my way into a much more manageable condition. For the most part, I still have my moments. Sometimes the emotions are quite powerful and can set upon us quite quickly, catch us unawares. But it has made the anxiety and the depression far, far more manageable than I would have believed, say, 18 or 20 years ago.
Thank you. And I imagine it helps you, because the thing with depression and anxiety is it is kind of a thought disorder in a lot of ways, where our perception is skewed towards the negative and the most scary situation. I can imagine that practicing Stoicism helps you to take things less personally.
Less personally. That which is frightening is less frightening. That which is irritating becomes less irritating. If you are familiar at all with cognitive behavioral therapy, as developed by Aaron Beck, or rational emotive behavior therapy, as developed by Albert Ellis, if you read those two and others who write on the same kind of topic, both of them credit Stoicism as being the wellspring for the various forms of cognitive behavioral therapy that are, at least to my knowledge, by far and away the most effective forms of talk therapy for dealing with anxiety, depression, and related mood disorders. So the Stoics were onto this a long time ago, a couple of millennia ago, and we have just sort of recently, in a significant way or in significant numbers, rediscovered their methodologies and their understanding of the human condition. So, had it not been for Epictetus, there may well have been no CBT, REBT, and related therapies. So, people who get that kind of therapy, whether they know it or not, they are really indirectly learning some of the basic principles of Stoicism.
And so to talk specifically about your book, Meditations on Self-Discipline and Failure, Stoic Exercises for Mental Fitness.
Well, kind of for mental illness.
To dealing with your mental illness. That's the name of the book. But so your meditations now, Marcus Aurelius has meditations. So how closely is this based on that, or is it your own thoughts?
The format is derived in part from Marcus Aurelius' meditations. I came up with the idea when I was rereading his meditations. It occurred to me that what he was forcing himself to do was to remind himself daily what kind of man he wanted to be, what constituted virtuous behavior, what he wanted to pursue, what he wanted to avoid. He challenged his own irrational responses or his bestial or animalistic sort of emotional responses to various challenges. And it occurred to me that this was not only a good exercise, but that it would be really interesting to have a 21st century version of meditations. These are my own thoughts. I'm not writing from his perspective. And to have these meditations written by someone who, rather than being, the most powerful human being on planet Earth, Roman emperor, someone who is more or less nobody. I mean, no one knows who I am. I'm not famous. I have no special degree of power. So I'm hoping that the everyman, the everywoman, the common person will read along with me. And I have written the book in second person. So, and that was intentionally a device to draw the reader into the experience. I want the reader to read the word you behaved in the following fashion, or you failed to control yourself once again in this particular arena. Much as Marcus did. Marcus's meditations were initially written only for his own use. The initial title, if it even counts as a title, of the work was To Himself. It was kind of a bedside journal he kept. So, and it was published after his death, posthumously. So I did the same thing. I started off just using this as an exercise to force myself to focus on my failures of self-discipline, hence the title, and to correct them as best I could. After a while, it occurred to me, I am generating enough of these meditations that this could potentially be a useful resource for other people who are struggling with the same sort of conditions that I struggle with. And not just anxiety and depression, but just dealing with the human condition in general. I'm a professor, and sometimes I have difficult interactions with other faculty or administrators or students, or I hit traffic and, it's enervating in one way or another. So I hope that almost anyone can find themselves and find experiences in my book that resonate with them, that are very familiar to them, and they can sort of read along with me as I attempt to deal with these conditions, address them, try to compel myself into a rational frame of mind. Perhaps when I've started off with anger or started off with some kind of dysfunctional mental state, they can sort of see me talking myself back into a state of reason, or trying to anyway.
UBC Careers Day and Graduate and Professional Schools Fair is happening on October 18th and 19th from 11 to 5 p.m. in the AMS Student Nest, and features over 150 exhibitors for you to connect with to explore current or future employment, academic, or involvement opportunities. To help you prepare for this event, the Center for Student Involvement and Careers is holding learning labs on October 16th and 17th to ensure that you are ready to impress exhibitors on the day of the event. For more information, visit students.ubc.ca and search for Career Fair.
We are speaking with William Ferriolo. He is the author of Meditations on Self-Discipline and Failure, Stoic Exercise for Mental Fitness. He has a PhD in philosophy, and he teaches philosophy at San Joaquin Delta College in California. So he's had a lot of time to think about this stuff. Now, I'm just wondering, William, how closely you, with regards to the format, did you read Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, and then so each section you'd sort of read his and then write your version of it, or is it more loosely based on the ideas?
No, the connection is far more the connection with his work, it was just reading the Meditations that kind of motivated me to start writing my own. Okay. The style of writing and my way of expressing Stoic principles is much closer to Epictetus. Probably fewer people in your audience are familiar with Epictetus's work, but you can still get the Discourses of Epictetus and the Enchiridion, which is, it means handbook. It's kind of a condensed version of the Discourses, almost like the Cliff's Notes for it. Epictetus he's closer to being the inspiration for the content of my Meditations. He's kind of my heroes. If I were to list my great philosophical heroes, it would be Epictetus and Diogenes and Socrates. Epictetus was born a slave. He had a very cruel master by most accounts, and he was crippled as a result of his master torturing him. So we have the bad leg in common. We have that affinity. And he is really, really a tough taskmaster. I mean, he does not allow himself or his students to slide in any way. There's no excuses are permissible. And my book very much has that tone and tenor to it. It's, you know, when the word failure appears in the title, you should probably not expect it to be a feel-good read. It's not happy talk therapy. I am much more so, well, somewhat more so than Marcus does, much more as Epictetus tends to. I am insisting that I do everything in my power to maximize my reason, my wisdom, my virtue. And anytime I fall short of more or less perfection, which is almost constantly, but anytime I fall short of that, I'm admonishing myself, and I'm kind of not exactly berating myself, but I am very tough on myself in the pages of this book. And since it's written in second person, the reader could, if you don't read the introduction carefully, you could get the impression, wow, this guy is telling me that I'm a loser, or this guy is telling me that I'm weak. And it's important for the reader to know that those are thoughts I'm directing at myself in the pages of the book. So in the first instance, I'm speaking to myself as Marcus was. So anyone who reads the book should not take it personally. I'm being hard on myself and being tough on myself. The reader is free to detach from that aspect of the book.
Thank you.
I'm not sure, did that answer your question, or did I wander off track?
I think a little bit of both. It's all okay. It's all good. I have so many questions about this because I have just started studying Stoicism, and it's a great opportunity to ask you because you've spent so much time studying it. As I'm reading Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, I notice that some of the language is so archaic that it takes more of my mental energy just to even try and understand what he's saying, aside from actually contemplating the intent of what he's saying. But I also kind of don't want to just read what you're writing because I'd rather go to the source. So how do you recommend people balance that?
Well, yeah, if you are reading translations of the Greco-Roman Stoics, there is some terminology that is a little bit, when translated into English, it's a little bit awkward. It might help to learn a few basic terms that they used and learn how the translations into English tend to be a little bit infelicitous. Luckily, in my book, I don't use any Greek or Latin terms. For example, the term that they use to refer to the ultimate goal of Stoicism, the goal is the attainment of eudaimonia. Now, that often gets translated as happiness, but that's really a ham-fisted translation. What it really means is flourishing, living well and doing well. It means living the virtuous life. If you want a translation, it's easy to become confused about what a particular expression means in context. And even when I say the virtuous life, when people in the contemporary sort of largely Judeo-Christian Western world, when they see the word virtue, I think they tend to associate that with behavior in accordance with God's commands or Christ-like behavior. But the Greco-Roman Stoics did not mean that at all. The word they used was arete. And although it gets translated as virtue, it really means excellence. Right. So one can reason excellently or one can reason poorly. So I understand there are some artifacts of translation that can make reading Marcus Aurelius Epictetus a little bit difficult. You have to work past the semantics to get to the content. Before you can understand what the guy is saying, you have to work past these sort of semantic hurdles. I've tried to in my meditations, I've tried to keep it in as close to plain English as I possibly can. So, again, I'm not doing what Marcus did. I'm not doing what Epictetus did. But what I have written in my book is inspired by what they do. I don't even discuss all of the same topics that they do. I discuss contemporary events and my reaction. And I try to do it as close to Frank Bush as possible. So, I have heard the complaint before that, it's hard to wade through the terminology when you read these ancient philosophers. That's unfortunately pretty close to being unavoidable if you can't read them in their in the languages in which they wrote. Luckily, mine was written in English, so.
So read yours.
It's actually not a bad idea to kind of start with mine and then go to the ancient sources. I'm not in any way delusional enough to believe that I am a comparable intellect with those guys. I'm not fit to carry the hem of their tunics. But if you are just learning about Stoicism, and if you read some contemporary sources like Massimo Piliucci and Donald Robertson and Chuck Chakrapani and maybe the Ryan Holiday books that are selling so well, if you read those first and then go back and read Seneca, Marcus, Epictetus, you might actually find, and not just you, but your listeners, you might actually find your comprehension of the ancient texts enhanced by the contemporary work.
Thank you. That's helpful. I have been reading The Daily Stoic, which is mm-hmm. the Ryan Holiday one. And I have been reading yours as well, The Meditations on Self-Discipline and Failure, which is the book that we're talking about today. Our guest is William Ferriolo. And yeah, there's just so many questions. I was excited to have you on the show because I just started looking into Stoicism, which I learned about from Tim Ferriss, the guy who wrote The 4-Hour Workweek. And it feels like it's really important. I mean, I guess it's probably always been important to consider rational thought and to challenge our immediate emotional reactions to things that happen in the world. But it's interesting reading your book and how you'll call yourself out on things, like the way that we all kind of tend to judge other people, and then we get to feel smug that, like, oh, well, I'm so much more high-minded because I took 5 minutes to think about this. But then we don't see that we're just doing the same thing that we're judging everyone else for doing. So right. Can we talk about that for a minute?
Absolutely. One good starting place, because it's sort of fresh in everyone's experience, the recent elections. I believe you're in Canada, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm in the United States, and of course, we just had this election that half of our country roughly has completely lost their mind over. We've got people in the same family who won't talk to each other because one voted for Trump and the other voted for Hillary, and they both are shocked that their family could possibly have betrayed them in this way. It's the very fact that there's a conflict there results from a failure to understand a couple of fundamental facets of the human condition. Number one is we have no control over what other people believe, what they value, what influences them to vote one way or another. We have no control over the outcome of the election just beyond our one vote. And I live in California, so my one vote is largely epiphenomenal. I mean, my vote for president means nothing. It's obviously the Democrats are always going to win California. So if we allow ourselves to become enraged or to become frustrated about the outcome of this election or of that event we couldn't control, people get really upset if their team doesn't win, their baseball team, their football team. If you take a step back from the natural inclinations and the common impulses, and if you realize, I'm getting worked up about what a bunch of grown men are doing with a ball. you kind of take a step back and say, yeah, that's unhealthy, it's unwise, it's irrational, and obviously there's nothing I can control about this. And if you think, well, but the election is far more significant than a football game, it probably is. However, the election is no more within my control or your control or someone else's control than is the outcome of a football game. And getting angry about it will not overturn the results. Destroying your familial relations, your collegial relations, your friendships with other people it's not going to benefit you. It's not going to change the direction of the nation in some way. And more importantly, and this is really the fundamental thing that folks want us to focus on, whatever the external affairs, however the election turns out, if we focus solely on being wise and virtuous persons, if that is all that we allow to concern us, then the outcomes of elections and, you know, economic states of affairs and so on, they really fade into the background and they have far less purchase on us. They have far less power to unbalance us. The Stoics told us that we should seek to be wise, courageous, self-disciplined, and just. And if we just focus all of our mental energies on improving ourselves in those areas, and we let the external world that we cannot control unfold as it may, as chance or God or the laws of nature will have it, without emotional attachment, without allowing it to sort of hurl us into despair, we will all be a lot better off, and we'll all be we'll be better human beings. We'll be better spouses, better parents, better citizens. We'll probably end up being kinder and gentler with each other. But we just inveterately fall into this habit of losing our composure, losing our emotional and psychological discipline because some event has occurred over which we simply have no control. But we let ourselves get caught up in that. We let ourselves get caught up in, you know, this emotional attachment that ultimately drives us to anger, frustration, despair, not healthy.
We are speaking right now with William Ferriolo. He has a PhD in philosophy, and he teaches philosophy in California. He's the author of Meditations on Self-Discipline and Failure, Stoic Exercise for Mental Fitness. Now, you mentioned the idea of being self-disciplined and of being just and virtuous. And what I'm noticing is that there's a whole lot of different ways that people define justice and virtue. And that seems to be a challenge because I feel like we're all doing the best that we can. Some of us might be doing better than others, but we kind of have these worldviews that we believe are right and true. As a Stoic, are you sharing this book to hopefully wake some people up, or because you can't really control if people question their assumptions or not? So, yeah.
Right. I try to restrict my concern to what I can control. So I can control whether or not I write the book. I can control the content of the book. I couldn't even control whether it got published or not. If no one had agreed to publish the thing, then it wouldn't exist, or I would have to publish it on my own. So it's very important that I not tether my happiness or my contentment to people reading the book and agreeing with it, or agreeing with me, or adopting a Stoic worldview. I can't compel anyone to do that, nor would I want to. If I could wave a magic wand and convince you and all your listeners to agree with Stoicism, I would not wave that wand. If one does not arrive there through one's own efforts, there's something artificial about it. So my goal is to present Stoicism in as accessible a contemporary form as I can. And in my book, I don't even present the theory, the history, the evolution of the Stoic school. Plenty of other people have done that. Massimo Cagliucci has done a good job of that. Donald Robertson, lots of other people. A.A. Long has done that. I just want to show the reader what it is to think in this way, to focus on wisdom and virtue, to recognize one's failures. My assumption is that my failures and the difficulties that I face and that I notice are largely going to be shared by the vast majority of the people who read the book. And I can offer them this methodology this approach to governing the human condition. I can explain to them what I take to be self-discipline, what I take to be courage, what I take to be justice, and why, right? And then they can decide for themselves whether they agree with my perspective, whether they share some portion of the worldview, and they either will or they won't. And I always tell people, I'm sure some people are going to read this book and hate it. They're going to think it's just terrible and it was a waste of their time and money. Other people will read it and will probably think it was a valuable experience. And I suspect some will read it and their reaction will be, I don't know. Don't know if this is worth it or not. If I let myself become concerned about their reaction, and if I let myself emotionally or psychologically become dependent upon people loving the thing or the number of copies it sells, then I'm being very unstoic. I'm being irrational, and I'm allowing my concerns to fall on things that are not virtue and decency and within my control.
Thank you. So, William, how often do you find yourself being unstoic? Because I know none of us are perfect.
Let's see. What time is it? Since this interview started, probably 30 or 40 times. That's only a slight exaggeration. I mean, I know that you have a show, and this interview is going to be shared with other people. And I have, while we've been talking, and even while I've been talking, in the back of my mind, there are these worries that, I did not express that as clearly as I should have, and people are going to think that I don't know what I'm talking about. That's an unstoic thought. The first part of it, I did not phrase this as clearly as I could have. And so let me remind myself the next time to be more perspicuous, more clear. That's fine and stoic and dandy. The second thought, people are going to think ill of me, and that's bad. That's not stoic at all. I can't control what people think of me, nor should I be concerned with it. If I am virtuous, which, by the way, I'm often not, but if I am being virtuous on a given occasion, and if everyone thinks that I'm not, if everyone thinks that I'm a failure, everyone thinks that I'm a terrible person, but if, in fact, I'm doing the right thing, doing the best I can to do the right thing, I should only be concerned about my best efforts to be decent, virtuous, honorable. And if no one else sees it that way, that is simply not my concern. That's the stoic attitude.
Thank you. I appreciate your willingness to share that, because I feel like in our efforts, I mean, you mentioned that you are quite hard on yourself in this book. I'm kind of actually wondering how you balance that, because we should strive for excellence, but if we beat ourselves up all the time, that takes away energy from pursuing self-discipline and excellence. So where's the balance?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And one can be overly harsh on oneself to the point of giving up, to the point of losing hope. You want to note your failure, sort of gently admonish yourself to try to avoid that failure in the future, but you don't want to obsess on your failures. I mean, I would have no time to do anything else if I obsessed on my fail. I fail so I'm such a, you know, at one level of description, I'm such a disastrous human being that if I did nothing but think about all the ways which I failed to be virtuous, I would literally have no time for anything else. One thing to do, what I find this useful, when I foul up, which happens on a daily basis, I have this phrase that I call to mind, and the Stoics did. The Stoics advised us to keep maxims at the ready, quick, pithy expressions that we could readily and easily call to mind, to sort of jog our memory, to remind us to focus on this and not on that, to behave in this way, not in that way. And I've kind of developed one of these. When I foul up and when I behave poorly and I become aware of it, I think, oh yeah, I'm a talking ape. I just remind myself, you know, we're essentially a species of ape. The fact that I'm not literally leaping about, shrieking and flinging my feces is like half a win. So if I fail to be perfectly virtuous on a certain occasion, I notice it, And I remind myself, okay, I don't want to be like that, but for a talking ape, it's understandable that I might slip up. You know, you look at history's greatest heroes of reason, right? You look at the someone like a Socrates or a Buddha or Jesus or someone a little closer to the contemporary period, Gandhi. All of those people, they had their bad moments. They slipped. They were less than perfect in their execution. So we should not be so hard on ourselves that we actually stultify our progress, that we actually impede our own progress with self-loathing or self-hatred. That's a trap you can fall into.
So would you say, William, that your "I'm a talking ape" statement is kind of an act of self-compassion?
Yes. Yes, at some level it is. It's a way of reminding myself that although I have made a mistake and I ought not to have done so, it's not exactly a hanging offense. It's not exactly irredeemable, or it doesn't irreparably, you know, foul up my progress. It doesn't mean that I cannot do better next time. And, you know, all too often, people will try on a worldview, so to speak. They'll endeavor to kind of follow a particular regimen, even if it's just something like a diet. You know, so when people just try to consume fewer calories for a while, and they'll slip up, they'll eat something they shouldn't have, and they'll think, "Ow, I'm weak. Why do I even bother? I may as well just give this up." That's not rational. That's not a courageous response. To a courageous person does not meet with challenge and failure by saying, "I give up." There's nothing virtuous about that. It's a kind of a way of saying, "I messed up, but it's really not that surprising. I am, after all, just slightly smarter than an orangutan. So, yeah, I messed up, but I'll try and do better next time." A bit of gentleness thrown in with the kind of rigid regimen that I hope to impose by myself. It has to be softened. The hard edges have to be softened a little bit, but only a little, more than a little, and it gets too soft.
Thank you. And it sounds like also, I mean, just looking at the whole human species as talking apes really would help to have a bit of compassion for the very ape-like behavior that happens so frequently with the people that we might be observing and getting stressed out about.
Sure. When people behave towards us in ways that make us angry or frustrated or throw us into any dysfunctional mental state, if we can remind ourselves, yeah, apes do that. It's not that surprising. I've done that kind of thing before. Take the example of driving. We've all had this experience. Almost everyone has. You're driving and someone cuts you off, or someone kind of drifts into your lane, and it makes you both frightened and angry, because you just put my life at risk, pal. You could have killed me. As soon as that passes, as soon as that first wave of adrenaline, that adrenaline dump has passed, if you think, you know, I've done that. I've momentarily drifted into the other lane because I, you know, whatever, lost concentration. Or I've inadvertently cut people off. I wasn't trying to kill them. It's not malice. It's not someone out to get me. It's just, this is one of those things that happens because we're imperfect. And then it's much easier to let it go, to let the other driver off the hook. Say, look, it happened. Try, you know, I hope you try to focus more on the future, and so will I. And you let it go.
But that doesn't mean you wouldn't honk your horn at him. Because he needs to be aware that he's in your lane, right?
Right. It's one thing to honk your horn. It's another thing to honk your horn and then remain angry and flip him off and curse him out. The honking the horn is a, hey, pal, wake up. I think there's nothing necessarily unstoic or irrational about that. But if you then remain fuming the rest of the ride home, or you try to cut him off, you know, just to get revenge, then yeah, now you're behaving more like an ape than a person. Now you're behaving more like a child than an adult. And of course, but I've certainly done all these things. I do not want to give your listeners the impression that I do not fall into all these traps on a regular basis, because I do. I have a terrible temper, have my whole life. It's not nearly as terrible now as it used to be. I frequently get frustrated, not as frequently and not as intensely as I used to. There's gradual progress, at least in my case. Maybe others will make quantum leaps, but for me, it's a gradual climb. And I stumble. I stumble all the time.
We are speaking with William Ferriolo. He is the author of Meditations on Self-Discipline and Failure, Stoic Exercise for Mental Fitness. And William, I'm curious, obviously, when you say meditations, you mean something a little bit different than what most of the audience here might interpret that as. So what do you mean by meditations?
That's correct. Typically in the contemporary world, when we see the word meditation or think of meditating, we think of something more in the Buddhist or Hindu tradition. You know, one sits in the lotus position and tries to clear one's mind or whatever, you know, in pursuit of nirvana. This is in the Western tradition, meditations are much more frequently written meditations. You have the meditations of Marcus Aurelius. You have Tolstoy's Confessions. There's kind of a long tradition of writing down one's thoughts, one's analyses of conditions, of one's response to those conditions. So these are written meditations. There's no need to, play Enya in the background. you need not adopt the lotus position. You don't have to light incense. You're free to do so, but you don't have to. You just read along with me. So I am meditating in the Western tradition, sort of an intellectual pursuit of the reasoned response to some stimulus, as opposed to a mere knee-jerk response or an irrational response or worse yet, an irrational response to some stimulus, and reminding myself of my flaws. Different people, of course, struggle with different concerns. They have different tendencies. You have to be willing to introspect honestly and be brutally honest with yourself about where your weaknesses are. And, of course, you have to devote more attention to those. So that's what I'm writing about in this book. I'm writing about what has occurred, how I responded, how in many cases my response was irrational or less rational than it ought to have been, and how to improve the next time this kind of stimulus arises.
Thank you. So it sounds like it's more of a contemplation rather than what most people like the sitting and meditating. Do you meditate, though, in the quieting your mind sense?
I have attempted to do so. I am bad at it. It's one of my other failures. I have what the Buddhists refer to as the monkey mind. I have studied a fair amount of Buddhism, and there is a tremendous area of overlap between Buddhism and Stoicism in terms of practical counsel and behavior. So when I was struggling even more so than I do today with anxiety and all the attendant dysfunctional mental states, I did try to turn to Buddhism, and I did try to practice various forms of meditation. I just found that I could not make much headway, even after extended periods of attempting to do so. Ultimately, I reached the conclusion that in my case, whether it's a cultural phenomenon or whether it's just a particular mindset that has greater purchase with me, Stoicism has been much more useful to me than Buddhist techniques of meditation. The Noble Eightfold Path is all well and good, but it is, for me at least, a little bit alien, a little bit harder to get my mind around and hard to behave in accordance with than the tenets of Stoicism. I would not be surprised if, for other people, they might find Stoicism slightly more alien and might be more comfortable with Buddhism. Either way, I think pursuing either is probably one of the better worldviews, one of the better value systems you're likely to find out there. I think Buddhists are doing just fine. I think Stoics are doing just fine. I think you can be both. In fact, I I know people who are both. But as meditation goes, just to directly answer your question, you can tell I ramble on too much. It comes from giving lectures. I'm not good at it, and so I don't do it anymore.
Thank you. So from a Stoic point of view, you mentioned what a person is more comfortable with, but we also want to get a little more comfortable with discomfort to prepare ourselves for, because life is inevitably going to be uncomfortable.
Oh, yes. Yes, it is. And Stoics and their precursors, the Cynics, they advised people to learn to increase the degree of discomfort that they are able to tolerate, physical discomfort, emotional, psychological discomfort, because the world is, as I always tell people, the world is going to beat the crap out of you. There's no way around that. The world's a rough place and no one gets out alive. So you have to be able to rise to the challenge of all sorts of discomfort, all sorts of pain, all sorts of emotional and psychological challenges. So the more you do that voluntarily, the more you subject yourself to dealing with challenges voluntarily, when they arise involuntarily, you'll be better able to respond in a rational and self-disciplined fashion. So it is, I think, advisable not to grow too accustomed to ease and luxury and kind of artificial means of inducing serenity, because the world is not going to sort of treat you gently. One should not develop that expectation. Another thing Stoics taught us to do is to challenge irrational expectations or unrealistic expectations. That's the source of a lot of needless suffering.
Thank you. Well, we could probably spend weeks talking about this, but we are almost out of time. So I'm wondering, William, what you would like to leave us with today.
I published a paper some years ago in which I kind of compressed the bare basics of a kind of a Stoic methodology. I can give this to you pretty quickly. I'm going to have to oversimplify it a bit, but it's called the IDEA method, the idea method. And I refers to, the I stands for identify the real issue. And always remember, the real issue is not outside of you. It's not the fact that, you know, you don't have that much money in your bank account or you got a conflict at work. The real issue is your emotional and psychological mismanagement of whatever the external condition is. You're allowing yourself to be unbalanced by it. D tells you to distinguish very carefully between what you can control and what you cannot control. Don't obsess on what you can't control. Focus all of your mental energy, all of your resources on what you can control, and that's just your will. It's just your ability to deliberate and choose. E refers to exert effort, mental effort, where it can be effective, which is on oneself. I can't make you do or believe anything. I can't change the economy. I can't change an election, but I can change myself so as to adapt and remain serene and rational, whatever life throws at me. And then A stands for accept the rest, accept the externals. There's a Nietzschean phrase, amor fati, which means love of fate. Learn to love the fact, not just accept in the sense of shrugging, but learn to embrace the fact that you are here in a world that is anthropic, a world that allows for human life, which is wildly improbable. Now, whether it's because the world was designed by some intelligence or whether it's, you know, it's a multiverse, an infinite number of universes, forget that. Here you are. And we are all very fortunate that we get to breathe in and out and we get to have conversations like this and we get to try things like writing books or getting an education. Embrace that and be grateful for the fact that you have an opportunity to draw breath and live a human life. If you do that, you're going to be, for the most part, you're going to be okay.
Thank you. Just one clarification on the exerting effort, the E part. You mentioned that that's mostly focused on ourselves and how we're perceiving and strengthening ourselves. But that does that mean that we would never try to influence another?
You can set an example for another. You can advise others. There are all sorts of methods. You could threaten others. But what you should not do, and what it's irrational to do, is to insist that they conform to the dictates or to the advice that you have set out before them. I can encourage you to learn more about Stoicism. I cannot compel you to do so. And if I were to insist, no, this person must learn more about Stoicism or I cannot be content, that's where I've become irrational.
Thank you for that clarification.
Yeah.
Is there something else you wanted to say about that?
No, I was just going to sort of extend the example. If if I ask my stepson or my stepdaughter to do something, and they refuse to do it, and if I order them to do it and they refuse to do it, right, there are still rational methods of dealing with that kind of reluctance, that kind of recalcitrance. If you think, well, she made me angry, she made me frustrated, he made me lose my temper, now you've just become irrational. No one can make you adopt any mental state. You can be insufficiently self-disciplined so that you slip into one of those negative mental states, but don't go blaming the world on it. Blame your own failure of self-discipline.
Beautifully said. Thank you so much. We have been speaking with William Ferriolo. The name of the book is Meditations on Self-Discipline and Failure, Stoic Exercise for Mental Fitness. I would encourage you to pick up a copy if any of this conversation has resonated with you. And I want to thank you so much for investing your time in this hour to learn more about Stoicism. And thank you to William for being with us as well. I want to send you lots of love. Be well. Namaste. Up next is Parts Unknown with DJ Chris Arific on CITR 101.9.